Hello and welcome to the Picture House podcast, our late December edition. It's the last podcast of the year. Well, the last traditional podcast of the year before our big end of the year review. Round of applause.
Woo! Woo! Yes.
We're going to talk to you today about some of the big films that are coming to cinemas in time for the Christmas holidays, in time for New Year, when people are off work and maybe you want to go get escape the family and watch a movie on the big screen. I'm Sam Clements and today I'm joined by Sarah Cook. Hello, Sarah.
Hello, hello.
Thank you for coming back.
Always a pleasure.
It's the last pod of the year. Does that fill you with remorse, with regret, with sadness?
Sadness. But also excited for a new year of movies.
Well, that's a good way to look at it. And also this week, some of the best films, arguably, maybe some of the best films of the year are coming out. And we are lucky enough to be able to talk about them. Before we talk about the end of the year movies, shall we have a look at the Picture House top five, the top five highest grossing films currently playing in Picture House cinemas? What do you think might be on this list? What are people flocking to the cinema to see, Sarah?
It was a really mixed bag of films last week. So I think maybe The Old Man and the Gun.
The Robert Redford's reportedly last film, Evs, but maybe not because he seems to change his mind.
They should just say hiatus. They should stop saying when retiring.
I think he's just having a holiday.
He's deserved it.
Well, okay. Old Man and the Gun, that's a good guess. All right, so in at number five, we've got Sorry to Bother You, the Boots Riley. I think it's his feature debut, right?
Yes.
Which played at a load of festivals. People seem to love this film. I haven't seen it. Have you seen it?
Seen it twice.
Oh my God, wow. I love your enthusiasm.
It is the weirdest film I've seen this year. It is not the film you expect. And I don't want to delve into further than that. It's brilliant. Lakeith Stanfield's great. Tessa Thompson is the MVP of the whole year. The visuals are great. Armie Hammer is great. But it just does not go in the direction you think it's going to go.
Tessa Thompson has had a pretty good year.
Phenomenal year. And I think her next year looks just as good.
Men in Black. Sign me up. I'm in. I'm all in. What do you think might be at number four?
Oh, maybe Shoplifters?
No. Shoplifters is brilliant, Sarah. But we've talked about Shoplifters. It's over.
No!
No, it's still on in some cinemas, but sadly not in enough to make it into the top five. In at number four, it's Three Identical Strangers, the new documentary from Tim Wardle about this, like, it is stranger than fiction, isn't it? This amazing story of these triplets who were separated at birth and they realise that they are triplets as they are, well, they're just finishing college, I think.
So yeah.
Just as at the beginning of their adulthood and then they become celebrities. I think this film is incredible and I, on my Letterboxd account, gave it 5 stars.
Yeah, I'm still not over this film. Of the ending flummoxed me more than I thought it was going to.
Mm.
And it's just the coincidence of how they met.
Yes.
And how they found out is just staggering.
Well, it's like, crazy, isn't it? So like, it's in the trailer, so not a spoiler. And it very much is the beginning of the film that they find out. But it's the beginning of the college year. And this guy starts his first day at college and everybody's like, hey, good to see you. Didn't think you were coming back. And they're hugging him and stuff. And he's like, who are you? I've never met you. And then very quickly he learns that someone he bumps into, his roommate, was his triplet, his twin, but not twin, brother. And they meet up and then they find out there's a third one. And it's absolutely bananas. So do check that out. It's great to see it on a cinema screen because people were gasping. It contains audible gasps. One of my favourite things to spot when I'm watching a movie. In at number three, it's Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald, which I can't actually remember if we talked about on a podcast before because I saw this one late. I think it's fine. It's not as good as the first one. It's not a terrible film. There's a whole lot of plot. It feels very much like a middle movie, and hopefully they're setting it up for an amazing third movie. But definitely one for the hardcore Harry Potter fanbase.
Yeah, it's one that the more I think about, the more I don't like.
Really?
It's very exposition-based.
Well, it's a lot of talking.
Yeah.
So much talking.
And it's really indicative of a book writer going to screenwriting.
Yes.
In the fact that they have to explain things not naturally. So there's a lot of heavy explanation and it's like, oh, that's not really how people talk or discover things, and it really upsets me.
I feel like it might have been good if J.K. Rowling, who is an amazing author, maybe collaborated with a screenwriter.
Yeah.
That would have been good. Maybe for the third one. In at number two, your guess has come good. Old Man and the Gun is there, number two. That's a pretty good opening for a... It's basically an independent movie, isn't it? It's a small indie movie with an amazing cast. Robert Redford, Sissy Spacek, Casey Affleck, and directed by David Lowery, friend of Picture House, who's been on this very podcast talking about this very film, if you check your iTunes feed, listeners. David Lowery is so nice. What a guy.
Such a lovely gentleman.
We're so spoiled as well, because he's so prolific. Last year we had Ghost Story. The year before that we had Pete's Dragon. He just keeps churning out these amazing movies.
And they're all really good and have all this, like, their own tone and atmosphere. And
he's a really, like, special filmmaker in how, like, he manages to do such a diverse range of movies.
Yeah.
An experimental film with Casey Affleck under a sheet, a big Disney movie, Old Man and the Gun. And Old Man and the Gun feels like a 70s, like a proper 70s crime caper. And it pays homage to all of those Robert Redford classic roles. But it in itself kind of is one of Robert Redford's classic roles. Like, this is an iconic Redford performance.
Absolutely. And opposite Sissy Spacek, that is one of my favourite romances on the big screen.
Yes.
This year. That filled me with so much joy. And yeah, Robert Redford's so charming in this character, who isn't necessarily a good character. Like, he's not a nice guy.
But he's not a bad guy.
But he's not a bad guy. He's just a cheeky, chappy criminal who robs banks. And
it's okay if you rob banks if you smile, right?
Right, yeah. Like, if you're an old man, you can get away with it. Don't quote me on that.
This is sort of like bothering my potential top films of the year list. Like, it's sort of hovering in there. It might, maybe on a repeat viewing, it might make it in. But in at number one, it's really exciting. This film basically had a one night only show as a preview, and it did so well. I know at Pitch House Central it sold out two screens.
Oh.
Free Solo, this new amazing documentary about free soloing, which is mountain climbing with no ropes.
Yeah.
And like, it's like proper mountains. Like, some of the climbs the sort of star of the film, Alex Honnold, does are like 4 hours of climbing with no rope up, you know, there are some huge mountains in and around California and things, and it's incredible. I love this film, and it was so popular last night. I really hope that bodes well for its UK main release, because it comes out on Friday.
That's amazing for a film that's not technically out yet.
I know, it's got in there just on that one show. But I mean, you saw Pitch House Central last night, two sold out screenings,
and our other screening that we've had is sold out as well. And went on sale and sold out on Friday with the Q&A. It's just, I didn't expect it to be so popular, because it's just a documentary about climbing, but...
But it's like, you know how in Mission Impossible everybody's like, Tom Cruise really flew that helicopter and Tom Cruise really hung off that thing for a bit. In this, and it's like 2 hours of this guy hanging off that thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that bit of Mission Impossible, but for a whole movie. It's so... I was sat next to another pod colleague, Toby King, who joined us on the pod earlier in the year. He was stress-eating popcorn. At the end of the movie, he finished his tub of popcorn, and he turned to me and he was like, I wasn't hungry, but I was so stressed. And he just had to keep eating popcorn to like keep it in the seats. And it really... And you're like, you're sort of knowing, because it was followed by a satellite Q&A with the star of the film. So you're like, well, he didn't die, but... It's pretty dicey still. There's a lot of like accidents and other climbers and all that. It's tense. The whole film is tense. And it's got this amazing score by Marco Beltrami, which really like rams home the tension. So yeah, quite a stressful experience. Definitely one to see on a big screen.
I probably won't watch it because I can barely get up ladders without freaking out, let alone a mountaineer person without...
Yeah, the no rope thing is...
The no rope thing is
kind of bananas.
I want to see it for the visuals, but I just know that I'll probably be... Like, I'll treat it like a horror and hide behind my scarf for the whole film. I won't watch it.
I think you should put yourself through... It's worth it. It's worth the stress. So that's the top five. Pretty good top five there, guys. You've been seeing some good movies. So as you mentioned at the top of the show, we're going to focus on some of the films which come out sort of mid-December, late December, and on New Year's Day. So on the menu, we've got Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, Aquaman, Mary Poppins Returns, and The Favourite. Shall we go through them in that order, Sarah?
I think so.
Now, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. I saw this film, you saw this film, but not only that, you interviewed the producers and co-writers of the film, Lord and Miller, which, you know, I mean, they are behind The Lego Movie, 21 Jump Street, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. I think it's got their fingerprints all over it.
Yeah, absolutely. Their humour is just throughout, and their emotion. They're so good at balancing comedy with emotional arcs, and I do think... It is a classic Lord and Miller production.
It's kind of a crazy one to do a plot summary of, but could you give like a top line what happens in this film?
Okay, so basically Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is based around a new Spider-Man who came into the comics in 2011, I think, called Miles Morales. He's a teenager. He's an intelligent teenager, but what he wants to do is pretty much slack off. And one day he's bitten by a spider. But this is the same time as Peter Parker is doing Spider-Man. So he's trying to figure out who he is as a new Spider-Man. But along the way, the universe is split up dimensions fold into one another, and a bunch of Spider-Men come out, including Spider-Gwen, Spider-Noir, and a Spider-Pig. So Spider-Ham. So lots of different variations of Spider-Man, and Miles has to rise up to the mantle, as well as trying to figure out not to let the universe fold in. And
so it's kind of a postmodern, very self-aware Spider-Man movie, acknowledging that there are lots of Spider-Man comics, Spider-Man games, Spider-Man TV shows, Spider-Man movies, and that loads of people have played this iconic character, and there's lots of different versions of him. And the fact that in the beginning of the film there are two Spider-Men, Peter Parker and Miles Morales, together, I guess, is like a good way to set that up. I think it really goes into like the comic kind of lore around Spider-Man, doesn't it? And it pulls out those obscure characters like the black and white Spider-Man, Spider-Man Noir, voiced by Nicolas Cage, who's like a hard-talking 1930s gumshoe detective. And, of course, the talking pig, who I think was a human bitten by a pig.
Human bitten by a pig, absolutely.
Yeah, so I don't really understand the background of the character, but they do sort of make a joke about how he's not a man bitten by a spider. He was a human bitten by a pig.
Yeah.
And he's turned into Spider-Pig or Spider-Ham.
Spider-Ham, and they're actual comic books. I didn't realise this. Spider-Ham isn't something just for this movie. He's actually comic book lore.
It feels like he's the embarrassing uncle of the Spider-Man universe.
Voiced by John Mulaney.
Voiced by John Mulaney.
And it has to be voiced by John Mulaney. It couldn't have been voiced by any other person.
But
so,
the film can pull off that stuff. Like, it can do sort of like the hard-hitting coming-of-age story with Miles Morales, who's having a fractious relationship with his parents, and he's got a cool uncle who he prefers to hang out with. And like, I mean, one of the Spider-Men die. Peter Parker dies in the film and basically hands the mantle over to Miles Morales in the very beginning of the film, so I think that's okay. And then lots of other Peter Parker show up anyway. But like, it deals with quite a lot of stuff, but it's all done in a very tongue-in-cheek sort of way.
There was a Venom end of credit sequence that showed that Peter Parker had died.
Oh, that's true. I mean, for those hardy people who stayed through all of the credits of Venom, I'm sure a lot of people just wanted to leave the theatre.
Yeah. And it's surprising, because if you told me at the beginning of this year that a Spider-Man animation would be in not just my top films, but top five, and I'm eager to go see it again and again,
yeah,
I would have laughed at you. I would have just been like, this is nonsense, because we've had so many. Spider-Man Homecoming came out last year. We had Venom this year. We've got Far From Home. Spider-Man's in Infinity War. We've got all the... We had the reboot and then a reboot. And it's just been everywhere. But to then present something so fresh and so unique and so glorious and realised, and then to do it better, just be like, here's an animation, it's going to be the best Spider-Man film you've seen.
I think, in, you know, the question is, can you ever have too much Spider-Man? And seeing this film, no you cannot.
No, no. And it's good, because what you realise with Miles, with Spider-Man as a hero, is that he is your average kid. So he's not a billionaire, he hasn't got lots of resources, he's a kid, and Miles is so fractured by a lot of things. I think he's more relatable now, because Peter Parker was a nerd, offense to Peter Parker, and he wanted to explore and study and do all these things, but Miles doesn't. He doesn't want the responsibility, and I think that more rings true. I think he's more of a hero in today's language.
I think it's come at the right time as well. Like, we've had a really good run of the new Tom Holland version of Spider-Man in the Marvel movies, Avengers, Homecoming. And we've also had a new Spider-Man game on the PlayStation 4, which has been super popular. So it feels like we're sort of ready for a new good Spider-Man movie. And I think this is the movie. In terms of the tone, I think if you like the Lego movie or Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs or 21 Jump Street, you'll love this film, regardless of your relationship to Spider-Man. I think you'll just go with it. You'll accept it's kind of a bananas sort of universe, and you're just, it's so funny. It doesn't really matter if it's a bit weird.
Yeah, yeah. And then the emotional art. I did not expect to cry at this film. And I did. I blubbed a lot.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I took a friend who I didn't think she'd enjoy it. And I've been trying to convince a lot of adults that they should come and watch his animation with me. You should all go watch his animation. It's not just for kids. It's a very, very good one.
I agree with that. I think the marketing does look quite young, because it's super bright, and all the cartoon Spider-Mans and the one who shaped like a pig. But look beyond that. It's a really great movie. And say, if you like 21 Jump Street Lego movie, this is a film for you. So a thumbs up for Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Speaking of super men. The other superhero film out on the same day as Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is Aquaman. I guess it's part of the DC, the other side of the comic book tracks, the DC Universe movies. And we haven't had as many DC films in recent months as we have Marvel movies. I think this is the first DC film of the year, and only film of the year, maybe?
God,
they had Justice League and Wonder Woman last year. and it's kind of quiet this year. He, Aquaman, was in Justice League. He sort of had a small role, played by Jason Momoa. I thought he was all right in Justice League. Like, it wasn't a great film, but I think his stuff was pretty good. So I was sort of looking forward to a dedicated Aquaman movie. And it's directed by James Wan, who is an amazing director, directed the Conjuring films. And I thought he might bring something quite inventive to this. What James Wan has done is he's brought everything to this. Like, it's not just his horror roots. It's not just the superhero stuff. He's brought in, like, an Indiana Jones-style action-adventure. He's brought in a Lord of the Rings-style, like, warring kingdom all based under the sea. He's brought in some of the amazing visuals from films like Tron and Avatar. There's lots of, because it's dark under the sea, lots of like neon things glowing. He's brought in like a love story. It's and a bit of soap opera, and it's kind of like Spider-Verse is quite overwhelming because there's a lot going on. This is quite overwhelming because there's just so much of it to take in. And I don't know if it's entirely successful, but I smiled throughout the whole movie. It basically starts with Nicole Kidman playing an Atlantean queen who washes up on the sea to a lighthouse keeper, and they fall in love. And then a few years later, they have a baby, and it turns out that she's on the run from an evil emperor under the sea, and they come and trash the lighthouse, and she gets taken kidnapped and all this sort of stuff. And it's like this, like, yeah, like quite Shakespearean sort of thing going on in a world where people talk underwater and ride around on giant seahorses. Bananas. Do you think you'll see Aquaman?
Yes, because it looks like Jupiter Ascending under the sea, and that I love Jupiter Ascending, and I love ridiculousness. I love films that know they're ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I also love Patrick Wilson, and I think cheesy, hammy villains in ridiculous settings. I'm going to watch it. I'm going to watch it and secretly enjoy it and not tell people.
It's so ridiculous. It's like, but it's fun. It's like Flash Gordon with seahorses. So if that, you know, works for you, then go for it.
It really works for me.
When I saw the film, I did tweet afterwards, like, Aquaman is a mix of Avatar, Jupiter Ascending, Lord of the Rings, Indiana Jones, and The Little Mermaid, or something like that. And then someone from Warner Brothers got in touch saying, can we use your tweet for promotional purposes? I was like, wow. I was like sort of half complimenting it and sort of half saying how crazy it was. But by all means, use my tweet.
Use a tweet. And I think you're the first one that alerted the world to the drumming octopus.
Yes. So there's an octopus that plays the bongos in the movie. Several critics have picked that out for good and bad. I know Ali Plum off Radio 1 was very keen on it. Robbie Collin in Telegraph, not so much. Doesn't like the drumming octopus. So yeah, the drumming octopus is the real divider with this movie. He's on screen for half a second.
He's going to be like the biggest meme of December.
Well, it's going to be a great gif.
Yes.
Such
yes.
a good gif. Okay, so you're in for Aquaman. That's good to hear. I might give it a second go if I can watch it in like something like 4DX or IMAX, like a big, more immersive experience, maybe.
I really hope at 4DX they really spray you. Like, if it's an underwater and it's 4D, they have to like just buckets. Just like, get under the sea.
So I was in a cinema watching 4DX the other day, and it had snow, like real life snow. Well, 4DX snow, but
4DX
basically snow. So there was an advert, a Christmas ad played, and at the end of the ad, it started snowing on screen, and it started snowing in the cinema.
That's amazing.
Mind blown. How do you feel about the prospect of a second Mary Poppins film?
Well, I mean, I was half and half.
Yeah.
For a while, because I don't agree with what Disney are doing with their films at the moment. Because go back to the originals, they're so good. They're so
Do you
good
mean the turning a lot of their cartoons into live action?
Yeah, films. It's treading a lot of old ground. It's like, you loved Mary Poppins, but the minute Emily Blunt was on like the first trailer, and I was like, do you know what, I'm in for all of this. It's Ben Whishaw, it's got the voice of, you know, the voice of Paddington, Lin-Manuel Miranda, Emily Mortimer, and Dick Van Dyke's returns, and I'm quite jealous that you've seen it.
Yes, so I was lucky enough to see the new Mary Poppins film, Mary Poppins Returns, which is coming out like 2 or 3 days before Christmas. It's perfectly timed for this type of film, something the whole family can watch. And Mary Poppins is such a staple of, you know, the TV listings over Christmas time. So this is Rob Marshall, director of Into the Woods, Chicago, the fourth Pirates of the Caribbean film, which is not great, but he is a really great director, I think, and he's so good at musicals. He has a background in choreography as well, and he always works with the same team, so he brings that sort of, you know, the amazing visuals you remember from Chicago to the Mary Poppins world now. And it basically continues the story after the first Mary Poppins starring Julie Andrews. It's the Banks children are grown up. Their parents have sadly passed away, but they have children of their own now, or George does, the Ben Whishaw character. And they're at a time in their lives, it's set in the Depression in Britain, and they're at a time in their lives where they really need some help. If only there was a magical nanny who could come. So he's about to lose his house. They've got a crazy housekeeper played by Julie Walters who's not really doing any favours. The kids are basically looking after the dad because he's depressed because his wife, their mother, has passed away off screen. So it sort of joins this family when they're all in a bit of disarray and they really need some help sort of sorting their lives out. I won't ruin it, but Mary Poppins' entrance into the film is perfect. After, like, she's so well known and she's so iconic, and we've seen Emily Blunt in all of the trailers, but the first like 15, 20, maybe even 25 minutes, she's not in the movie, and it's a lot of people having a bit of a bad time in London, and it really makes you yearn for, you know, some sort of like floating super nanny savior. When she does finally show up, it's such a like sit up in your seat, jaw drop to the floor moment. I was like, that's perfect. So they've really put so much love into this, knowing that she is so iconic. Like, let's return her in the right way. And yeah, it's a musical like the original, so full of all new songs, not based on any pre-existing songs. They do a really good job of not treading over the old songs or not relying on like, hey, we're going to do another version of Feed the Birds from the first film. All of the songs are new, but there are some like small musical cues maybe, or like the odd nod, but they don't do a Spoonful of Sugar Again or anything like that. And I sort of admire that, because you're right, Disney are really like plumbing the depths of, remember this? You liked this when you were young and you'll like this now. And with this one, they've taken that, but they've made a whole new story with this amazing cast, as you mentioned. And I do think Emily Blunt as Mary Poppins is pretty perfect casting.
Practically perfect.
Practically perfect.
Practically perfect. I have to ask, does Lin-Manuel Miranda rap?
No, but he gets close to it. And not wanting to name drop, listeners, but I got to interview director Rob Marshall today, and we did talk about that briefly. So that is a separate podcast, an interview with Rob Marshall. Yeah, they go for some quite old style musical sort of nod. So think of like MGM musicals from the 1930s and 40s, where like music hall is the thing, and fast talking it's not rap, but Lin-Manuel Miranda's rap skills do come in handy for one particular sequence, which is set in sort of a big sort of music hall style space.
Amazing. That sounds right up my street. Especially because I love the Christmas time musicals that we're now getting.
Yes, well, yeah, exactly. And it's not a Christmas movie, but it feels absolutely right to watch it at Christmas. It's all about family. It's all about coming together, being a better family unit. They're going through a hard time, which seems to be a bit of a trope with Christmas films. You know, families at their lowest low. And if only they could come together with a magical nanny. But yeah, and all of the songs are really delightful. But it deals with grief. It deals with like the stress of family and growing up as well. Like these are, the Ben Whishaw and Emily Mortimer characters are the children from the first Mary Poppins film, but they've forgotten Mary Poppins. They remember having a nanny, but they don't remember any of the magic stuff. So it's kind of nice that that's how their journey has progressed. You know, they've written it off as a childhood fantasy.
So like an aspect of Hook in that, and I quite like that.
Yeah, it does. It did feel quite a lot like Hook. And I know a lot of people don't like Hook. I think it's pretty good.
Hook is practically perfect. I know it's got like critical, like, I know I don't want to go off on a Hook tangent, but Hook is the best.
Well, Steven Spielberg, the director of Hook, thinks otherwise. He does not like that film very much.
He's wrong. Spielberg, he's
Steven,
you're wrong.
But yeah, I do think this is definitely the one to watch. It feels like if you like the Paddington movies, this is this year's Paddington, and it has Paddington in it, but playing a human man rather than a little bear. It's definitely one to get the whole family out to see. Those people who maybe don't go to the cinema very much, I think, will like this film. People who do go to the cinema and who love Lin-Manuel Miranda and the work of Rob Marshall and Emily Blunt will have the best time.
I'm so excited. I can't wait to get into it.
I'd be really interested. So Lin-Manuel Miranda is basically playing the Dick Van Dyke chimney sweep type character, but in this he's a lamplighter, like a gas lamplighter called a Leary, and he is doing a Cockney accent.
Is it a Dick Van Dyke style Cockney accent?
It is.
This
it is
makes
as
me
good
so
and as bad as Dick Van Dyke's Cockney accent in the original film.
I feel like they had to. I feel like they couldn't have had someone who's American in this and go, you need to do a great one. It's like, you need to be slightly off.
Well, I think he's like, I'm doing what Dick Van Dyke did in the film. I'll sort of try for the most part, but I'll let it slip sometimes.
And Dick Van Dyke's in it.
Yeah, so
90
Dick Van Dyke
years
is
old.
He's got a really good credit as well. It's not like an and or a with. It's like a very special appearance by, and it is special to see Dick Van Dyke. He is not playing the same character from Mary Poppins. He is playing another character. But there's also like Meryl Streep is in this film. Colin Firth is in this film. It's a really good cast. Would highly recommend. I cried 3 times watching this movie, and I looked, the first time I started to blub, I looked at my watch and it was 17 minutes in.
Oh,
and
no.
I was like, flip, it's going to be a long 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
But it wasn't. It was delightful. And I did cry 2 more times. But it was all happy tears, you know, remembering the past and things. So yeah, big thumbs up. The soundtrack is sort of annoying that when I watched the film, I mean, I loved that I saw it early and I got to interview the director, but the soundtrack isn't available yet. So I'm really looking forward to the film coming out so I can buy the soundtrack because I want to listen to it again and again and again. I don't know my favourite song yet. There will be one, but I need to listen to it some more to just see. I think it's definitely one for the cinema, and it sounds like it's right up your street, Sarah.
I love musicals, unashamedly. I mean, you start your character, it could be the word. I've not met a musical that I don't like. That's a bold statement.
I'm trying to try and think of some terrible musicals.
Some terrible musicals. But I liked it. One of my favourite films of all time is Repo: The Genetic Opera. And that's trash, but I love it.
Oh, wow.
So...
okay. I think maybe you're the... well, this is a good one, thankfully. There's also, like the original Mary Poppins, there's a hand-drawn animated sequence, which I read the press notes for, and they got lots of Disney animators out of retirement because no one can do the hand-drawn animation like that anymore, or not as many people. So they got all of these old animators out of retirement to sort of do this amazing 15-minute or so animated sequence in the middle of the film. And that's incredible as well, just sort of seeing how real-life people are interacting with the cartoons, like in the original Mary Poppins. Big thumbs up. That's out on the 21st of December, and you can listen to our podcast with director Rob Marshall when you're listening to this, maybe afterwards or before, not at the same time, that would be confusing. Now, those are the things that will be in cinemas over Christmas break, and that's a pretty good selection of movies, but we've got something completely different out on New Year's Day, the new film from director Yorgos Lanthimos, who directed The Lobster, Killing of a Sacred Deer, quite hard-hitting world cinema films. Sarah Cook, what is The Favourite?
So The Favourite revolves around Queen Anne, played delectably by Olivia Colman, in perhaps her most perfect role, even though every role she tackles is a perfect role.
Yes.
Because she's that good. And she is this kind of spoiled, rich, greedy queen who demands everyone's attention or not attention, and she's pretty demanding, and she's flanked by Rachel Weisz's character, and they're best friends. Rachel Weisz's character uses the queen to get her own political means put forward, and then this young girl called Abigail, played by Emma Stone, turns up and decides that she doesn't want to be at the bottom of the pile and works her way up to Queen Anne's favour, and it's all about Rachel Weisz's character and Emma Stone's character facing off against one another to get Queen Anne's seal of approval.
It sounds like a fun kind of like triangle, like tricky relationship.
Yeah, and it's so good. And it is three of the best working actresses having a lot of fun with Yorgos Lanthimos' particular brand of dark, brooding comedy that's funny, but like, you know, you're laughing and then it's quite sad and it's, you know, there's lots of things going under the surface. I think it's his most accessible film. It's a very period drama. It's gorgeous. He uses natural light in pretty much most of the scenes. And it is a lot of fun, the antics that they get up to on this, because there's lobster racing, there's goose racing, there's lots of bunny rabbits, there's cake eating. It is outrageous, but it's so much fun to watch. And again, the acting is, you can see why Olivia Colman is scooping up nominations and awards left, right and centre, because she has never been better. They've finally given her the queen role she deserves. Well,
yeah.
The second one now, because she's going to be the queen in
The Crown.
The Crown,
the
yeah.
Queen of The Crown. So the tone, so it is, because I was wondering, I seen the trailer and I'm not sure if it's how the trailer's been cut or if it's the film. It looks, Yorgos is someone who I associate with very serious films, very dark films. Does it have that dark humour of Killing of a Sacred Deer or Order Lobster or like what?
I think it's more, it's funnier.
Mm-hmm.
There's more slapstick in it. It does have his trademark comedy on it. There is a lot of darkness to it, and it definitely, I think there's a moment where it switches slap bang into like the lobster-esque style of comedy more so than like the slapstick, because Queen Anne's outrageous and the things that she demands, and the dialogue is so funny, very Monty Python-esque style of dialogue, that it switches and gets darker and darker and becomes more Lanthimos.
Okay.
I think he's either been really smart where he's going, he's enticing someone with something more accessible and going, you'll enjoy this. Look, it's Olivia Colman eating loads of cake. Look at this. And then slaps you with this really like dark side, and that this is what you pay for, Yorgos Lanthimos. He's just such a good unique filmmaker.
Do you think people who haven't seen a Yorgos Lanthimos film before, do you think they'll enjoy this? Like, do you think is it going to be off-putting watching it, or do you think they'll roll with it?
Mom, we're hoping they roll with it. I think, like I said, it's accessible. So I think you might not want to take your nan to it, but you could take your mum. I think there's a lot more. It's not going to offer much more questions than like The Lobster does.
Okay.
It is that kind of a broader audience, but not broad enough. Like, you're not going to get Mary Poppins levels of people coming to watch The Favourite, but you are going to get a good, hearty crowd.
I'd love to see Yorgos Lanthimos' version of Mary Poppins. Maybe, like, Mary Poppins Returns again.
That would be so good.
Likewise, I'd like to see Rob Marshall do maybe a sequel to The Favourite. Who knows?
A musical version of The Lobster. I now want.
Sign me up. I'm so excited for this film. Like you say, it's been sweeping all of the awards, and Olivia Colman is sort of hotly tipped to win Best Actress at the BAFTAs and the Oscars. Do you agree with the praise that's been sort of showered on Olivia Colman for this role?
Yes.
Yes.
Although, I mean, I want to take this time to say that they should just scrap Best Actor and just do another Best Actress category, because the performances from actresses this year has just, and every time I think I've got like a top five, then like Nicole Kidman comes on Destroyer, or like Rosamund Pike in A Private War, and I'm like, this is enough, you guys need to stop being so good. So I think she's got some great competition, but I wouldn't be surprised if she scooped it up. I personally think it's between her and Toni Collette. And I think everyone thinks it might go to Glenn Close.
Yes,
for The Wife.
It's true. A legacy Oscar. Okay, well, I am really, really excited to see this film. It's out in cinemas on New Year's Day. I think at Picture Central it opens a little bit earlier, maybe from Boxing Day.
Yeah.
West End previews. So if you happen to be in town doing your Christmas shopping, maybe swing by Picture Central and catch the film nice and early. But this is like number one on my list of things to see. I'm so pleased to hear it's good, and I'm so excited to watch it myself. That's brought us into the 1st of January 2019. We have finished with 2018, apart from, I would love to know some of your favourite movies of the year, Sarah.
Ooh, You Were Never Really Here.
Wow, that was super quick. No delay.
I can't explain. That moved me in such a way that it's now in my top five films of all time. Lynn Ramsey is such a mastermind. But it's not just her. It's her relationship with Joaquin Phoenix, his character, Joe, and this hitman story that's so delicate and brutal and deals with PTSD in this unique way, and pairs this suicidal man with this abused girl and makes it the best friendship of 2018. And
Tom Townend's cinematography.
Oh, and Johnny Greenwood's score. Everything fits. This is just, it's just impeccable filmmaking. And I love it so much that I am trailing every top 10 list to make sure it's on there.
Oh, wow. What are you doing if it's not?
Writing in. Like an old woman. I'm like, dear
sternly,
sir/madam.
Yeah. Yeah, I think for me it might be Phantom Thread, but You Were Never Really Here is sort of number two. And yeah, both of them have Johnny Greenwood soundtracks.
Johnny Greenwood soundtrack.
So that's basically what it takes for me to love a movie, clearly. You Were Never Really Here is very economical. It's less than 90 minutes long. There's very little dialogue in the film. Joaquin Phoenix is, basically it's his body. It's how he moves, how he walks, how he sits. You see a lot of him just like slouching around with no shirt on, and he's like a man who really doesn't care anymore.
Yeah.
And I kind of liked that. It's a really fascinating film. I've seen it twice now, and it definitely benefits from a rewatch. I'm sure a third time, fourth time, even more stuff would come out.
I'm literally coming home early from Christmas just so I can watch it at the Prince Charles again.
Oh, wow.
On the 27th, I'm like,
Merry
bye, family. Gonna watch You Were Never Really Here.
Stick to your first true love.
Yes, absolutely.
Fantastic. Thank you, Sarah. So that's your number one film of the year. Our next podcast will be a few other people from Picture House, including Klebins, our joint MD and programmer extraordinaire. So I'm fascinated to hear what she thinks is best films of the year. But yeah, we'll all come with a little list and we'll do a bit of a review show. Review of the year. So thank you, listeners, for listening. Thank you, Sarah, for talking today. And thank you, Silk Factory. We're in, once again, in your amazing studio in Soho, which I absolutely love coming to. Silk Factory are proud supporters of the Picture House podcast, an awesome film marketing creative agency. They don't just do podcasts, they make trailers, online content, GIFs, social media things. Check their stuff out online. They have a great Twitter feed, which I enjoy following. Lots of good assets on there, which as a, my day job is film marketing, so I can just retweet Silk Factory and be like, here's a GIF for Disobedience. And that's super handy. We think they're great. So do go and check out their work on thesilkfactory.co. Thank you, listeners, for listening. Please do rate, review, subscribe, put some star ratings in after listening to this podcast. It'd be much appreciated. And we'll be back next week with a new episode. See you soon. Goodbye.